cultivate our motivation and think of the incredible potential that we have just because there's mind, there's consciousness. So mind is what is clear and knowing, what knows objects. So it has the potential to know all phenomena, and what hinders that is obscurations. So it might be a physical obscuration, not being able to see something, or it being too far away to hear, but then also other obscurations of afflictions and karma that prevent our mind from knowing many other kinds of phenomena. So we have that potential to know, and by learning the Buddhist path, we have the tools to apply to purify the mind so that we can perceive all phenomena. So seeing that we have the basic causes and conditions to attain full enlightenment, then let's put our intention and our energy into doing so, so that we can be of the greatest benefit to sentient beings, so that we can stop harming them and instead benefit them. And so set that intention to become a fully enlightened Buddha. There were some questions last week, and I thought I would start with the questions. So, somebody said, first a couple of comments, and she said, up until now, for the most part, studying and reading about the tenet schools has pretty much felt like the objective was more of an intellectual exercise rather than something that could actually be applied to examine our experiences and viewpoints. It is only now, with these recent teachings, that it is becoming clear why it is actually very important in meditations on emptiness and on ethics and karma as well, to really understand the different tenet systems beyond intellectual. Okay, so very good insight there. See, this is what happens when you endure through all the confusion of not knowing the vocabulary and the concepts, is eventually you see that it is important. So her questions, for each tenet school, what do they think can be achieved by following their particular method of analyzing the ultimate reality of how we exist? Well, I think all the tenet schools think that you can attain liberation. I mean, all religions, whatever they put forth as their version of the path, you know, they think that it will bring people to some kind of state of freedom of suffering. Okay. Now, of course, in Buddhism, the state that's free of suffering is a little bit different than in other religions. Because what we identify as suffering is different. Okay? So we're not just trying to eliminate the ouch suffering of pain, or which everybody, even animals, recognize, or the suffering of change, the fact that nothing brings lasting satisfaction in samsara, and that's something that most people who are serious about a spiritual path, whatever that path, they realize that. But also what's unique in Buddhism is what we call the dukkha, the pervasive compounded suffering, or dukkha, which is just having a body and mind under the influence of karma and afflictions. And so eliminating that and finding freedom from that is, you know, what we call liberation or nirvana in Buddhism. And so all the Buddhist tenet schools think that that's what they're going for. Okay? It's just that what they assert you need, what is the path to get there? There are different assertions about that. They all say it's the wisdom realizing the ultimate reality. But what they define as the ultimate reality is different, because what they define as the object of negation is different. Okay? So you can really see that in the different systems, when you change the object of negation, you know, it indicates some change in what they say is the true origin of suffering or dukkha, what they say is the true path, what they say is the true cessation. So it affects all different kinds of things. Okay? And the second question was, if becoming a Buddha is their ultimate goal, do all tenet systems aim for Buddhahood? That's a good question, okay? Because remember we were talking about last week that you can hold that tenet system as on the level of motivation or on the level of philosophical tenets. Yeah, you could be fundamental vehicle or Mahayana based on either your philosophical tenets or your motivation. Okay, the Vaibhasikas and the Satantrikas, well, put it this way, all the Buddhist schools talk about Buddhas and fully enlightened beings, but not all of them think that everybody is capable of becoming a fully enlightened being. Yeah, some of them say that the only fully enlightened beings there are what we call the wheel-turning Buddhas, meaning the Buddhas who turn the wheel of Dharma, who spread the teachings and give the teachings in a historical period where there's no Dharma. Okay? So they would say that the only ones who become fully enlightened Buddhas are those beings who will become the wheel-turning Buddhas. Okay? So some tenet systems say that. You know, and they say that actually the rest of us become arhats, fully liberated, you know, liberated from samsara, but not fully enlightened beings. Okay, and so those would be the Vaibhasikas and the Sotantrikas who say that. Then when you get to the Chittamatras, there's one branch of the Chittamatras that say that there's three final vehicles. You know. And then the others say that there's one final vehicle. Okay, so three final vehicles means that everybody has some innate predisposition towards either becoming a hearer, a solitary realizer, or a fully enlightened Buddha. And so once you achieve that particular aim that you have a disposition for, then that's the end of your path. Okay? Now, some of them say there's people with indefinite dispositions, and so it depends on what teacher they meet, you know, whether they become a hearer or a solitary realizer or a Buddha. But, you know, they would say once you become an arhat, that's it. You know, you fulfill that vehicle, you don't go on to full enlightenment. But when you get to the Majjhimaka and then the other branch of the Chittamatras, they say no, that there's one final vehicle and that everybody has the potential to become fully enlightened. Okay? So there is some difference there in terms of what they assert is the final goal. Okay? So she says, if becoming a Buddha is their ultimate goal, what do the different systems think actually leads to attaining that state? And the definition of the qualities, skills, activities, abilities, etc. of a Buddha differ according to the tenet school. Okay? So, a few questions in here. So what do they think actually leads to attaining that state? Well, for the ones that talk about all of us, I think all of them talk about method and wisdom. You have to complete method and wisdom, yeah. But of course, what you consider wisdom is going to differ according to what you consider the object of negation. Okay. Yeah, but the qualities are fairly similar, except there are some of the vivasikas that say the Buddha is not omniscient. They call it all-knowing. In other words, the Buddha has to turn his attention to a certain object and then he can know everything. Whereas the higher schools say that a Buddha just all the time always knows everything. Okay, so there are some differences like that. There's some differences about whether they say a Buddha has a form, you know, a rupakaya or a nirmanakaya, because there's some differences. For example, some the higher schools say that Shakyamuni Buddha actually became a Buddha a long time ago and was appearing as an ordinary person as a way to set an example for us. Whereas, like the Vibhasikas and I think the Satantikas also say that the Buddha actually was an ordinary person and went from the path of preparation all the way through to Buddhahood in that final lifetime. Okay, so there's some differences in assertions that way too. Okay. So maybe sometime, if you guys have lots of energy, we can go through all the tenet systems and talk about, you know, all their beliefs on these different topics. Yeah, it's quite interesting. Right now we're mostly focusing on, you know, what they say is the ultimate truth and conventional truth. Yeah?
Hearers and solitary realizers referred to how the person's their method.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like the final goal is just our hardship for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're asking if hearer and solitary realizer is the difference in the method that they practice, but you're saying it sounds like the goal is also different. There's differences in both. Okay, because the hearer and the solitary realizer don't have to accumulate as much merit as somebody on the bodhisattva path does, and they are aiming for arhatship, whereas a bodhisattva is aiming for full enlightenment.
What is that referred to, hearer and solitary realizer?
Okay, so a hearer is sent. Actually, a hearer isn't. There's some debate over the translation. Mm-hmm. Okay, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates the term as disciple. Yeah, and Jimpa does too, because at the time of the Buddha, remember there were all these different spiritual teachers, and each one had their disciples that were called Shravakas, because they were the ones that heard the teachings of the master, that particular master. Okay, so while Shravaka does mean, you know, to hear, to listen, implying hearing and listening to teachings, each spiritual teacher had their own set of disciples that were called Shravakas that heard their teachings. Okay? But here it's said that they hear the teachings and then they teach them to others. And then a solitary realizer is somebody who the Shravakas accumulate merit for, what was it? Was it three eons, three lifetimes, three something? And then they meditated mostly in the Four Noble Truths, whereas the solitary realizers accumulated merit for 100 eons, and their principal object of meditation was the 12 links of dependent origination. And then the bodhisattvas accumulate merit for three countless great eons, and their main object of meditation is emptiness. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's one way to kind of describe it. But they're called solitary realizers because one branch of them, there's different kinds of solitary realizers, but one branch of them, it's a particular kind of person who has made a determination that in their last life they will appear at a time where there is no wheel-turning Buddha. Okay, so they learn all the teachings in a previous lifetime, and then in their last lifetime, before they attain arhatship, they appear in a time when there's no wheel-turning Buddha. They attain arhatship, and they don't teach verbally, but they will often teach through their motions and their gestures. So it's said. Yeah. So that there's sometimes they're called solitary realizers, because that particular branch of them, you know, they practice in a very solitary way their last lifetime, you know, because there's no Buddha around and no teacher.
I was reading today that they attain something like a Buddha body. That's one of the advantages of being a solitary.
I don't know.
I was wondering, what are the other advantages given the time?
Well, you know, a lot of us, I remember we were asking Isila that too. It's like if you get the same arhatship being a shravaka and a solitary realizer, you know, most of us are lazy. Why not just do the shravaka path? And it seems like that there's just different people who have different inclinations. And, you know, some people feel more inclined to accumulate more merit and to meditate on the 12 links, and they feel more comfortable doing that. It was quite interesting when I was in Thailand. You know, they were saying that, you know, everybody becomes an arhat, but then there's some arhats that have clairvoyant powers and some that don't, some that develop deep concentration all the way through the, you know, all the form realm and formless absorptions, some that only attain access concentration. They were saying there's a great deal of difference, you know, among different kinds of arhats. And apparently this is, again, due to people's different dispositions and what they find interesting, what they find encouraging, what they want to do. Like Shariputra, you know, the Buddha's chief disciples, Shariputra and Moggallana, Shariputra was known for his wisdom. You know, that was like his speciality. Well, Moggallana was also an arhat. I also had the same wisdom, but he didn't, you know, he wasn't out teaching it so much. He was known for his supernormal powers. Okay, and all sorts of powers that he had. Whereas Shariputra wasn't known so much for that kind of thing. Okay? So again, it kind of pulls us out of our idea of, you know, cookie cutter things. Yeah, we get this idea that, you know, all arhats, you know, all Buddhas just, you know, stamped out of the cookie cutter. And, you know, it's not. Everybody's quite distinctive and, yeah. Okay. I mean, it's an interesting thing to ask yourself. If I became a Buddha, what do I think is going to change about myself? Yeah? What do you think is going to change? Well, I hope you say I won't be so angry, I won't have so much attachment, you know. But does that mean that you're going to not like chocolate chip cookies when you become a Buddha? You can still like chocolate chip cookies. I'll like chocolate chip cookies, and you'll like pizza, and, you know, everybody will have their own thing. Yeah, but we just won't be attached to them, that's all. Okay? Yeah. So, there, you know, there might be some Buddhas that have a great sense of humor, and some that are more playful, and some that are more serious, and, you know, they're quite different. Hmm? Okay, so don't think cookie cutter. And also, when we think of going from one life to the next, don't think of, you know, we have the same personality either. Even when you're a realized being, I mean, if you look at the 13th Dalai Lama and the 14th Dalai Lama, very different personalities. Very different. The 13th apparently was quite, you know, stern and quite, you know. And the 14th Dalai Lama, very different personality. Okay? So, okay. So those were a couple of questions. There's a few more. Another person said, what makes me, me? If I feel I do not exist, then who is in this chair? Okay. What makes me me? Well, that's a very good question. When you look inside, what makes you you? Is there anything special? Some special substance? Some special unshared something that by its very nature is who you are, unchanging? Yes, what?
My soul.
Your soul. Okay, the soul of your feet, I assume. What you got on the soles of your feet? Okay. So, you know, because we feel like there's something special that makes me me. You know, I'm not you, I'm not you, I'm not you. There's me, and there's something special that makes me me. But what is it? Yeah? Can you draw a line around it? When you look, yeah, when we look at what we associate the word me with, there's a body and there's a mind. Okay? Is there something special about your body that makes you you? Yes, there is.
Everybody's body is different than
everybody's. But are you your body? Is your body going to be your distinctive quality? And is there some permanent body that you have that's always you, that's different from everybody else? All changing. Then we look in our mind, is there some mental quality? Well, you know, there's the visual consciousness and, you know, auditory consciousness and gustatory that's gustatory, that's olfactory, that's tactile, you know, and the mental consciousness. Are any of them, like, distinctively me? No. Are any of my moods distinctively me? Any of my emotions? My emotions! Nobody else knows how I feel. You know? I mean, there's nothing in there, is there, that we can say this is like so completely different than anything else that is me, that if you saw this, you knew definitely I was there? Yeah? So what makes me me? There's just different causes and conditions that come together at a certain time. We give a label. That's it. Yeah? I'm merely labeled, nothing more than that. Then our mind goes, wait a minute, you got it all wrong. There's something more. I'm not just merely labeled. I'm not just dependent on conception. There's me. You don't understand. Okay, but you see how strongly we feel that. But whenever we examine and try and find what it is that makes me me, you know, we can't find it. And this is quite interesting, you know, when there's a person that you're very attached to, when you look and like, okay, well, what is that person? There's a body, feeling consciousness, feeling aggregate, discrimination aggregate, conditioning factors aggregate, consciousness aggregate. Same standard five parts you find in everybody. You know? What is distinctive that, you know, is special, that never changes, that exists from its own side, that you can point to as that person that you feel is, you know, the be-all and end-all of your life and is going to make you everlastingly happy. You know, there's nothing there. There's a body that's changing all the time and a, six different primary consciousnesses that are changing all the time, and all their emotions that are changing all the time, all their feelings that are changing all the time, all the discriminations that are changing all the time. What can you find in there? You know? And you look at somebody that you're very attached to now, and you think, oh, I know, you know, this heart of this person, and I know them. Well, imagine if you met them when you were 5 years old and they were 5 years old. Would you still feel the same way? Would you still recognize each other and feel, you know, oh, I know who you are? Yeah? I mean, when we were 5 years old, are we anything like what we are like now? That one we should say yes to. I still throw temper tantrums. I still go in my room and sulk. I still play jokes on people. Okay? And so the second part is, you know, if I feel I do not exist, then who is in this chair? It's not that we feel that we do not exist, you know? I mean, I think this person means just if I'm not findable, who's sitting in this chair? Okay? Who's sitting in this chair? The person that exists by being merely labeled by term and concept, independence upon the five aggregates. That's what's sitting in the chair. Or to be more specific, the body's sitting in the chair, isn't it? And it's only because the body's sitting in the chair that we say, I'm sitting in the chair. Mm-hmm. But we are not our body. Okay? It's only because the mental consciousness is thinking that we say, I'm thinking. But I'm not the mental consciousness. Okay? If I were the body, then every time I said I should be able to say body. So then I'm thinking would become the body is thinking. Or if I'm the mind, yeah, then every time, you know, mind and I would be synonymous. So every time I said I, it would refer to the mind. So then the mind is walking. I mean, it gets to be absurd, doesn't it? Yeah. So I is just this very ambiguous, actually. You know, when we say the mere I, we mean it's mere in the sense that there's nothing you can find there that exists from the side of the object. Okay. But things don't appear that way to us, do they? They appear as if there's something there from the side of the object. Yeah. And we believe that. Yeah. I mean, when we think of ourselves, do we think, you know, I only exist due to conception? Yeah? Yeah? What I call me is only a label in dependence on aggregates, nothing more? No. We don't feel that at all. We think there's something real and findable. But when we search to find it, we can't find anything. So, there we see there's some difference, there's discord between the way things appear to us and the way they exist. Yeah. Those two things don't match up. They're discordant. The way things appear and the way they exist. Okay, but we only know that when we start to analyze how do they exist. Okay. Then somebody else asked, if the Chitta Mantra believes that when no one is looking at a cup, it causes the cup not to exist, what did the Prasangika say about an unlooked at cup? Is it there? Well, first of all, the Chitta Mantras don't say that when nobody's looking at the cup, that makes the cup non-existent. Yeah? No, nobody's saying when you don't look, the Chitta Mantras aren't saying that. The Chitta Mantras are simply saying the mind and the cup that's perceived originate from the same latency on the mind stream. Okay? But just because I'm not looking at a cup doesn't mean, and I, you know, that cup and my visual consciousness are not arising together out of that same latency. That doesn't mean the cup is non-existent. Okay? The cup that I'm perceiving due to my karma isn't arising at that time. Okay? But we have some kind of shared reality, even though there's no external objects. You know, there's still things that we can talk about that we share. Yeah. So the Chitta, nobody's saying that when you don't look at it, it stops existing. Especially when I don't look at it, then it stops existing. Yeah. Now, an infant thinks that. An infant thinks when mama goes out of the room that mama no longer exists. Okay? But that's not what we're saying here. That things cease because we don't apprehend them. Okay? So similarly, the Tibetans tell one story about, maybe did I tell you this before, about some monks who came to see this Lama, and they were saying, you know, how is it that everything exists by being merely labeled? And does it not exist, you know, if somebody doesn't label it? And then the Lama, when they left, was saying, oh, it's a good thing that doesn't happen, because then if nobody's labeling this pillar, the whole house is going to fall on me. Yeah? So you can see, I mean, it isn't, the existence of that pillar depends on it being labeled. But it's not when somebody is not actively looking and saying pillar, 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 that then that doesn't exist. Okay? We talked about this with Guy, remember? It's very hard to understand. What does it mean just to be labeled? How is it that that exists? But, you know, I think that that example that that one Lama gave about the 4 pounds of butter, you know, whether if you weigh some butter and you know there's 4 pounds there, yeah, it's not that the butter always has to be on the scale for it to be 4 pounds of butter. Yeah. And it isn't like it becomes 3 pounds of butter when it's no longer on the scale and nobody's thinking it's 4 pounds of butter. Okay? So when we say things are merely labeled, we're not saying anything can be called anything. Okay? And we're not saying it goes out of existence when, coincidentally, it's me that doesn't happen to be labeling it. Okay. It's just saying things don't exist independent of the mind and independent of labeling. Yeah. But you see here, here's why the Svatantrikas, there's something appealing. Well, you know, there's something there, you know. Yeah, it doesn't exist without me labeling it, okay. But there's something there.
I mean, there has to be something there to be labeled.
Yeah, there's got to be something there that's really out there from its own side. I mean, it's got to be a cup from its side, otherwise how could I label it cup?
Well, no, it's not,
you know,
a cup,
because
something, and then you label it a cup.
No, but then I could easily label it an elephant. You know, it's got to have some cupness nature for me to label it a cup. Because if it didn't have it, then I could label it an elephant. But then the problem is, if it has some cupness essence in it, then there's no need to label it. Yeah. So you're stuck between this thing of, you know, well, if if you label it, there can't be anything existing from its own side. And if it exists from its own side, then you can't, there's no use for labeling it. And you're stuck between this because it's like, well, there's something there and I label it.
Yeah.
But no.
Well, this is more that there's something there, and then the thing that I see is what I'm labeling,
mm-hmm.
but it's not really what's there.
Yeah.
Something that's something.
Yeah. We may not be giving it the label cup. Before we label a cup, you know, we may be calling it something.
Yeah.
Yeah. But somebody else certainly calls it a cup. Doesn't depend on me calling it a cup for it to become a cup.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm God and everything I label all of a sudden comes into existence. Yeah. Not like that, is it? Yeah. Yet, how could we posit anything that exists without being labeled? Yeah? Without being perceived, without being labeled, without being known. How can you talk about there's this creature, you know, in outer space that nobody sees? How could you talk about that? Because for it to exist, somebody would have to see it. Which means somebody's labeling it.
Out-labeling it?
Hmm?
Can't we see something without labeling it?
Well, without there being something there. I mean, what I'm saying is that we can't. Something cannot be established as existing independent of the mind. That's what I'm trying to get across. Okay? Yeah. But when we perceive the world, it looks like it's all existing out there independent of the mind, doesn't it? Yeah. Totally independent. The subjective reality, independent of the mind. But it's not. It's completely dependent on the mind. Okay, next question. Do we refute both the gross and subtle selves? I hope so. Because if neither of them exist, then they both need to be refuted. Okay, now, the thing is, when we talk about the self, you know, we're talking about the self-sufficient, substantially existent self and the inherently existent self. You can negate the self-sufficient self without negating the inherently existent one because it's coarser. But when you negate the inherently existent one, automatically you stop apprehending or grasping at the self-sufficient one. Okay? It's like if you destroy the bottom floor of a building, the top floor falls down too. But it's possible to take away the top floor and leave the bottom floor. Okay? Okay. So, let's go back to our chart with all the objects of selflessness. Beautiful smile. Who else is smiling at me? Oh no, the rest of you have it. Okay. You're turkey-ated? Was that what gives your turkey all the energy to do all this? Our turkeys act very strange in this season. Okay, so we see that all of the schools, except the Prasangika, yeah, the core self of persons, permanent, partless, independent person, okay, and the subtle self of person is the self-sufficiently, substantially existent person. Okay, and we talked about that self-sufficient one last time, you know, that you could see it either as like the shepherd and the sheep, yeah, or actually a more subtle way of saying it is the head scout and all the scouts. Okay? Then, you see that the Vaibhasikas and Satantrikas don't talk about a self of persons. A self of phenomena, but they may talk about, you know, there's no phenomena that exist as possessions of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Okay, so they may talk about phenomena not existing as the possessions of that kind of self. Now, when we get to the Chitta Mantras, which are the Mahayana tenets, they start talking about a selflessness, a self of phenomena, a self-grasping of phenomena, and a selflessness of phenomena. And so for the Chitta Mantras, that's what we were saying, there's, the subject and the object, appearing as if they're completely cut off from each other. Yeah, dualistic appearance of subject and object. And they're saying that the emptiness of phenomena is seeing that the subject and object, in fact, are not cut off, but they arise from the same seed on the mind stream. Okay? And then also another selflessness of phenomena that's related to this previous one is that, according to the Chitta Mantras, is that things do not exist by way of their own character, as the reference for their terms. Okay? Because if they did, then, you know, you couldn't have more than one term applying to an object, and one term couldn't apply to more than one object, and everybody would look at the object and see the same thing, the same term. Okay, see it, label it as the same thing. Yeah, so that's what the Chitta Mantras talk about, as, you know, seeing objects as existing from their own side, as being the basis of their names, that is the self of phenomena, and then the self-grasping of phenomena is what holds that, apprehends that, grasps that as true, and then the selflessness of phenomena is the non-existence of that kind of self. Okay? Then, when we get to the Svatantrikas, and we're not going to talk about the Yogacharyas and Svatantrikas, because it's getting a little bit too much detail for us. Okay, but when we talk about the Svatantrikas, then, you know, the self of person is the same, and they talk about a selflessness of phenomena, okay, which is things truly existent. And by true existence, what they mean is something that exists without being posited or labeled by the force of appearing to a non-defective consciousness. Okay? So they say that what exists is things appearing from their own side to a non-defective consciousness. In other words, to a consciousness that isn't hindered by, you know, having hepatitis so you see things yellow, or being on a moving train so that you see things moving, or by, you know, certain kinds of wrong views. They impede the consciousness from seeing clearly. Okay, so a non-defective consciousness, things exist by appearing, and then from the side of the object, and then from the side of the consciousness, positing or labeling that object. Okay, so that's how things exist. That's conventional truth for them. So what is non-existent is things, you know, existing without being posited by the force of appearing to a non-defective awareness. In other words, things being truly existent. Okay? So they say that things appear from their own side, plus they're labeled. So then the self of persons, a way that things cannot exist is them existing without that happening. Without them appearing and without them being labeled. In other words, something that exists without depending on being posited or labeled by the mind. Okay?
Tell me an example of that. If that thing were to be conceive what we...
Well, it's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Oh, I see.
You know, well, except they don't, they say that that doesn't appear to the sense consciousnesses. But they would say something existing from its own side without our labeling it.
Mm-hmm.
Existing only from its own side,
okay.
You know, without our labeling it. They do say it exists from its own side, but not only from its own side. Okay? Whereas the Prasangikas go a little bit further and say there's nothing existing from its own side. It exists purely by being labeled. Okay? And then also, the difference between what they call the self of persons and self of phenomena, there's a difference between the Svatantrikas and Madhyamikas, or and Prasangikas, because for the Svatantrikas, negating a self-sufficient person is negating the self of persons. Negating a truly existent person is negating the self of phenomena. So for them, what they call the self of persons and phenomena, it depends on what exactly you're negating there. Whereas for the Prasangika, you're negating the same thing clear across the board for everything. And self of persons is when you're negating it on persons, and self of phenomena is when you're negating it on everything else but persons. Okay, so that's the difference between them.
Just to clarify, with the Svatantrikas, you're saying that it's the depth of negation.
Right.
Not, that's the difference.
Yeah.
Not the object of that negation.
Right. Well, it's with the Svatantrikas, it's the depth of negation, so it's the object that is negated. You know, one is self-sufficient, one is truly existent for them. Okay.
So could you...
So negating the true existence of a person is the selflessness of phenomena for the Svatantrikas.
But you couldn't negate true existence of a person.
Yeah.
Would be the selflessness
of phenomena for the Svatantrikas. Okay,
wow,
because negating the self-sufficient, substantially existent person is negating the self on persons.
Would you negate the self-sufficient, substantially existence of phenomena?
No. No, because remember, they are only that way in terms of being the possessions of that kind of self. Does true existence mean the same thing as for the Svatantrikas and the Prasangikas? No. Because the Svatantrikas, for the Prasangikas, true existence and inherent existence are synonymous. So lots of times when I'm just talking, you know, about emptiness, I say true existence sometimes inherent existence. From Prasangika view, both the same thing. For the Svatantrika view, they're not the same thing. Because the Svatantrikas say, there's nothing that truly exists, either conventionally or ultimately. But when you talk about inherent existence, there's nothing that exists inherently on an ultimate level, but on the conventional level, there's something that exists inherently because it's got to have some nature in it that makes it it. So even when you analyze, you can't find exactly what it is. Still, on a conventional level, there's something there. So they say.
Mm-hmm.
And the Prasangikas say, you can't say that. If you're saying that something's there on the conventional level, it's the same as saying that there's something findable on the ultimate level, too. So you're actually accepting inherent existence. Okay, so they have all sorts of debates back and forth about this. Okay. How much of it is actually said by the Svatantrikas? I don't know. I've always wondered about poor Baba Viveka. You know? Because, you know, I find it quite interesting that in ancient India, there was never the idea that they were negating different things. You know, there was the idea that there were some Madhyamakas who preferred, syllogisms, and some that preferred consequences. But they didn't pick up that there was a difference on the object of negation. It was Jay Rinpoche who picked up on that. Okay? And he did that by looking at certain of Bhava Viveka's writings, you know, and other writings, I think Janagarbha and a few others, and saying, well, they said this, so actually they must mean this and this and this. So kind of inferring by different things that they've said. But then you wonder if Bhava Viveka were here, you know, would he say, well, yeah, I really believe that? Or would, you know, Jay Rinpoche say, well, you've got to if you assert this, and then Bhava Viveka goes, oh, you're right, actually, I goofed. Or maybe, you know, when he wrote, he forgot a knot when he should have put a knot in, you know, or the scribe made some goof. We don't know.
So it would be hard to say that he actually asserts, or that any Satasha Dasi asserts that, oh yeah, really, if you look at the cup, there's, you know, something from the side. So
yeah.
To actually have them say that on paper would be a little...
Yeah, you know, I mean, well, I ask them, you know, what would a Svatantrika say when they look at the cup? What would they say it really is? But see, usually when they teach this, they don't teach it in relationship to the cup. They teach it in relationship to the person, to the self. Yeah, because perceiving an inherently existent cup, that's not the root of our samsara, you know. That's not our big problem that we go around all day thinking the cup is inherently existent, you know. But our real big problem is thinking that we're inherently existent, okay. So they always talk about that in relationship to the self, and also in a specific way in relationship to the self in terms of what is it that carries the karma. Because this has always been the big thing for all the Buddhist systems, is once you talk about no self or selflessness, the question comes, what carries the karma? Okay? So this is why they make such a big thing about what all these different systems assert to be the person. Because this is of incredible importance, what you assert to be the person, because that is what's going to carry the karma. And you've got to find a way to say that there's something that carries the karma. Otherwise, your whole system of ethics falls to tatters. You can't assert any kind of ethical conduct, okay? Which becomes a total disaster if you have a spiritual system without an ethical system. You know, it's just a mess. So, they've all got to find out some way to say, this is how you carry the karma. Now, from the non-Buddhist viewpoint, because at the time of the Buddha, all the non-Buddhists, they talked about liberation, they talked about karma, they talked about rebirth. These are things that, you know, you just grew up thinking about when you were a kid. Everybody accepted it. And so for them, it was very easy for the non-Buddhist systems. What is it that carries the karma? There's a permanent, partless, independent soul or self. There's an Atman. That carries the karma. You know? So, okay, got that answer. You know? That's how we carry the karma. That's how we assert, you know, ethical conduct. Of course, then they have the problem of, you know, how do you find such a self? But never mind that problem. At least they've established karma and its effects. Okay. So then the Buddhist systems, then they, you know, well, how do we, you know, what goes from one life to the next? So then they all come up with different assertions about what goes from one life to the next. So on your same sheet of paper, there's another chart that says the person. Okay. So if you look on that, the non-Buddhist schools, what do they say the person is? What carries the karma? What is the bare, raw bones thing that you find when you're looking for the person? Is something permanent, partless, independent self that is separate from the aggregates. Okay? So the soul that goes from one life to the next, that's permanent, partless, independent. Then the Vibhasikas, you know, remember, none of the Buddhists believe in that kind of person. Okay? So the Vibhasikas, there's a bunch of different views, because there's different kinds of Vibhasikas. So some say the five aggregates are the person. But that's kind of weird, because then how does the body go from one life to the next? That becomes a little bit of a problem. Then some of them say, oh, it's the consciousness aggregate. Okay? So, yeah, that makes some more sense. You know, the consciousness, yeah. Mm-hmm. The consciousness is impermanent, but it's still truly existent. And, you know, your consciousness is really you. And then there's another branch of the Vibhasikas, okay, that the self is inexpressible as either one or separate from the aggregates. Yeah. I think you're one of them. Yeah. Yeah, it does have a nice ring. The self is inexpressible as either one or separate from the aggregates. Yeah, it sounds kind of mystical, doesn't it? Yeah. Right. Okay. Then, you know, you get into different branches of the Satantrika. Some say it's the continuum of the aggregates. Yeah, but then if you include all the aggregates, that's kind of strange, you know, because the body does cease. You know, then some say it's the mental consciousness. Now that there, you're beginning to sound kind of reasonable. Okay? There's a mental consciousness that carries the karma. You know, the mental consciousness is the one that thinks, you know, all my opinions, all my ideas, all my unique creativity, you know, an eye consciousness is just an eye consciousness, no big deal. But my mental consciousness, my creativity, my literary ability, my musical talent, my electrical acumen, everything, you know, my mental consciousness is me. Yeah. Okay? And that goes from one life to the next. Yeah, mental consciousness, that sounds good, you know, because it can't be something tangible like a body, that's just too gross. Yeah, mental consciousness is not bad. You know, we think, doesn't it? Sounds okay. Okay. Then the Chittamajas say, well, actually, you know, there's a very special kind of consciousness that carries the karma. Because your mental consciousness is too busy thinking, and your mental consciousness, you know, there's too many different levels. There's gross and subtle levels and everything, you know. And so your mental consciousness is too busy with all this other stuff. There's one special consciousness. You know, the foundation consciousness, the storehouse consciousness, that's the repository of all the different seeds. So it's just this little treasure chest, and every time you leave an imprint, you drop it in that treasure chest, you know, and that just comes with you from one life to the next. And it's a neutral consciousness, it stores all the karma, you don't have to worry about anything getting lost. Okay? And that's what carries the karma. It almost sounds like a soul, doesn't it? Yeah? Yeah.
How dare you say
it? And, you know, and this is what I think you have to be very careful of, people who hold the Chittamatra view, is that sometimes people talk about it as almost as if it's a soul. And you know what? Sometimes when we talk about the Buddha nature, we can talk about the Buddha nature as if it's a soul. You know, oh, there's some pure part of me that is unchanging, that is never tainted by afflictions, that is always there. Oh, I have a soul. It's a pure soul. Yeah? So easy, if we don't understand Buddha nature correctly, to really make it into something quite substantial. And same way, if you don't understand the foundation consciousness, you know, it sounds like something inherently existent. But I think the Chittamajra, well, they do. The Chittamajra do say it is inherently existent. They do say it's truly existent. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because they say there's no external objects, so then the mind is truly existent. They say the objects are truly existent also, but they're not external. But the mind is the big thing, you know? And especially this foundation consciousness. Yeah, so you just throw your karmic imprints in the backpack and it comes along with you. Okay, so that kind of sounds, that's reasonable, although, you know, having a foundational consciousness can be kind of clunky. You know? Yeah, it gets so big. Yeah, I mean, all these seeds collected from beginningless time, you know, good thing they don't weigh anything, otherwise, you know, I couldn't lift them. Okay, but you know, when you hear these things, you can see, oh yeah, that kind of sounds good, you know, because there's one part of us that likes the idea of there's something there that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so even the satantrikas, they say, well, there's a subtle mental consciousness that goes from life to life, you know, it's impermanent, but it carries, you know, it carries the karma. And the Prasangika come along and say, all you guys have got it all wrong. All of your fancy assertions basically boil down to your accepting a soul. You know, at the bottom line, if it's truly existent, it's got to be permanent. If it's a foundation consciousness, it's, you know, got to be, it's got to be everlasting, you know, permanent like that. If it's this, if it's that, it all winds up, it has to be permanent. So you guys really got it all wrong. And then they all say to the Prasangika, well, buddy, you know, you think you're so high. What do you think carries the karma? And Prasangika says, the mere I. And then they go, what in the world is the mere I? What in the world are you talking about? Mere I. You know? And the Prasangika say, what is merely labeled by term and concept, independence on the aggregates? And the Satantrika say, well, we say things are merely labeled too. So it's different. And the Prasangika say, what merely negates, what merely excludes? Okay, because for the Prasangika, when you say things are merely labeled, it excludes any existence from its own side. But for the Svatantrikas, merely doesn't exclude any existence from its own side. It just excludes not having some labeling involved at all. Okay? So that's why the, you know, so this mere I, our mind like wants to fixate on it and say, I got it, this is the mere I. But you can't. Yeah? The mere I merely refers to what is, you know, labeled, posited, created, dependent upon the aggregates and the conception of the mind and the label. And when you search to find what it is, you can't find it. Whereas all these other systems say when you search to find what the person is, you can find something. You find the five aggregates, you find the mental consciousness, you find something that is indescribable as either, you know, one or separate from the aggregates. You know, they all say when you search for the person, you know, this person that carries the karma, there's got to be something that carries the karma, you will find something. Whereas the Prasangika say, the mere eye carries the karma, but when you search for it, you can't find it. Yeah, it exists merely on the conventional level, merely on the level of appearances. Yeah? Whereas we don't think something exists merely on the level of appearances. We think if it appears, it's got an inherent nature. For sure. Otherwise, how could it appear? If it didn't have a nature, how can it appear? But the point is, if it had a nature, how could it appear? Yeah.
I have a question about how it continuum then.
How what?
How you can have a continuum in a mere, really labeled
mm-hmm.
self. It
depended on previous knowingness, arisen from previous knowingness.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't that fit into state of foundation consciousness? That it's not truly existence, but it's dependent on previous knowingness in the same way that mm-hmm. this using label.
Okay, so how come that you can't just say, well, it's impermanent, that there's a consciousness that's impermanent and dependent on previous moment, but it's not truly existent. It's one moment and it's changing, so it's not permanent. Well, the thing is that if you say something is truly existent, okay, from the Prasangika viewpoint, truly existence means that it doesn't depend on any other factors.
Well, if it depends on the previous moment, isn't that factor?
Yeah. So they would say, if you say it's findable in any other way, if you say there's a person that's findable in any way, that it's truly existent in any way, then it means that it can't depend on other factors. So saying it's truly existent and saying it depends on the previous moment are contradictory.
Right.
Yeah.
Why can't you say a soul is existent on previous moments of the soul?
Why can't you say the soul depends on previous moments of the soul? Because the soul, by definition, is permanent.
Okay, so then I don't want to.
Huh?
Then I have the wrong kind of mix the two.
Yeah. Okay, so we have to stop now. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam
Guru Ratna Mandala Kandirya Tayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Travasti Abbey in the West flourish.